Marvin Acme. The rabbit cacked him last night. Just like a tune to drop a safe in a guy's head.
No matter, the rabbit won't get far. My men will find him.
I didn't kill anybody! I swear! This whole thing's a setup! A scam, a frame job!
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
He's a toon. You can drop anything you want on his head. He'll shake it off.
He'll break his heart. Goes to pieces just like you or me.
Hosted by Stuart.
Aw, poor fella.
Yeah, ain't I a stinker?
Justin.
I worked with a lot of wisecrackers, but you are despicable.
Gone, gone, stubborn beggar. I did it.
And Arnie.
That's what I call one seriously disturbed tune.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Ow! My biscuits are burning! Fire in the hat! Oh, eat green artichokes! That's smarts!
Listener discretion is advised.
You feeling frisky tonight, fellas?
Yeah!
Let's go.
Today we're discussing Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Starring Bob Hoskins, Christopher Lloyd, Charles Fleischer, Stubby Kaye, Joanna Cassidy, directed by Robert Zemeckis. This is Arnie, your Now Playing podcast host.
And Stuart.
And this is Justin, and yes, that is a rabbit in my pocket.
Oh man, I thought you were happy to see me. But I'm happy to see our patrons. Thank you, patrons who are with us this May, for supporting our show. Words fail me at my level of gratitude to all of you.
Yeah, I think this is year two. We didn't know how this patron thing was going to work, and you guys have told us, if anything, we've gotten the message, keep doing more shows, and how about this show, and you know, we're getting these donations, and it's wonderful. If only I had the time to do all of the things being suggested. We are doing Who Framed Roger Rabbit because this weekend, Detective Pikachu came out. It just seemed like something that needed to happen. We hadn't talked about what has been, I think, the most celebrated film to unify animation and live action. This was a perfect reason to go back and look at this 31-year-old film.
I thought we had discussed the most celebrated film to mix live action and CGI. Phantom Menace, right? With Jar Jar?
Cell-drawn animation. Okay, let's pre-computer. That's what's kind of amazing. It's not the first film to do it. I mean, you know, Song of the South, Gene Kelly tap dance with Tom and Jerry, Mary Poppins, Bedknobs and Broomsticks. The difference is...
a lot less racism.
Well, yeah, with Song of the South, I mean, there's a lot there. No, but what I was getting at, with all of those films previously, they were technical marvels, but not cinematic. Static camera. They just put a widescreen shot, planted the camera. It was just flat. We're not going to move the camera or do anything that makes it challenging for the animators. What Roger Rabbit tries to do is actually film it like a regular old movie with live action characters and use actual puppeteers and all to knock over trash cans and make it seem like the Invisible Man can later be drawn in as an animated character. That really hadn't been done before, and this movie took a big risk at saying it could be done in 1987, 1988.
I remember wondering when Back to the Future 2 came out, what took so long? It felt like forever between Back to the Future and Back to the Future 2. The answer is Robert Zemeckis made this. This took forever to do. It took a long time to film. It took a long time to plan. I had no idea that Disney bought the rights. First of all, before coming back to this film, I didn't know it was based on a book.
Right. Robert Zemeckis has always wanted to make. This was a passion project for Zemeckis. But when he started off in his career, he made a couple of bombs. Disney didn't want to have anything to do with him. But Disney saw this as a chance to revitalize its animation studio, which had completely floundered in the 1980s.
They bought the rights to the book the year it came out. 1981, Disney bought this. And it had been in production for 4 years with various people coming in and out, various actors, various directors. It was when Michael Eisner, the new CEO of Disney, the one who really breathed some new life into Disney pre-Bob Iger, when he came on, he was the one who looked at this project and saw it as a new hope for animation and got Steven Spielberg involved.
But that was because it had been reshaped from what it originally was. Who censored Roger Rabbit was the book by Gary K. Wolf, who, props, he's from Central Illinois. He went to school at U of I Champaign, just up the road here. He's a pulp science fiction novelist of very little other note. I couldn't see anything on his bibliography that I had ever heard of before, but he did write this book in 1981 that unified the worlds of detective fiction and comic strips, not cartoons. This was an era coming out at a time when newspaper circulations were huge, and everyone started their day by reading the funny pages. Peanuts, Garfield, Doonesbury. That is where Roger Rabbit is set. So how similar is the movie? Already, that's a big difference. You'll notice the title is different. Who censored Roger Rabbit? Censored is a euphemism for murdered. It's Roger Rabbit that gets killed, and Detective Eddie Valiant is investigating his death with the cartoon characters. And they use the comic strip thing cleverly sometimes, like all toons speak in dialogue bubbles, like they do in the funny pages. So, like, he digs through the last dialogue bubbles Roger Rabbit said to see who he was talking to and get clues about the case. Some of it works. It kind of feels like a Mad Magazine parody of both crime fiction and comic strips. And, you know, with Mad Magazine, the joke usually wears thin after a page or two. This thing's about 200 pages. I don't see a big franchise in it. I didn't see what Disney saw when they optioned it. I saw probably what they ended up using, a concept that has appeal. What if we brought together animation and detective movies? What would that look like? One of the directors they approached before Spielberg got involved would have been a good choice, Terry Gilliam. He was an animator for Monty Python. He had just made Time Bandits, which was a big hit, and does skirt the line between kids' fantasy and kind of like a dark adult satire. I mean, that movie's really nasty, and I always loved it as a kid just for that reason. He had the sensibility, I think, more than Robert Zemeckis, to make the book the way that it was actually written. Because the book is saucier, it's darker, it's much more like The Maltese Falcon than it is like Popeye or Nancy Drew.
You know, all that raises the question in my mind then, Stuart, is why even buy the property to turn it into what it became? I mean, would Roger Rabbit have been just as fine if it was Billy the Rabbit? Were they buying a name that they thought was popular to change it into something that was much different from the source material? Or what did they see in that that came to be what we know as Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I mean, what you're really talking about is the dark heart of Hollywood itself. I think the story of every project is it started out as one thing, and by the end of it, it went through the taffy puller and became this other thing. And sometimes it's beautiful. Sometimes you see the finished result and you go, oh my God, boy, they fixed that. It's so much better than it ever could have been. But a lot of times, yes, they take a property and mangle it beyond recognition. And you're like, well, with the way that you ended up, you might as well have just made it as an original concept. Hollywood's not good with that. They like to know that there is a source material. And they gave it to some screenwriters who worked on it for several years until it became the draft that Zemeckis got attached to. And Zemeckis, because he knew Spielberg and because he had had back-to-back hits with Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future, was on their A-list. They said, all right, you can do it. The real problem at that point was, I want you to do it for cheaper than you want to do it. Like, Zemeckis wanted $50 million, which would have made it the most expensive movie of all time, and they gave him $27 million.
And he spent $50 million. In the commentary, which was recorded for the 25th anniversary, he said, you know, I can finally say this was the most expensive movie ever made, and Disney execs were just sure this was going to tank. But Spielberg was there assuaging them, saying, this is not just going to be this one movie. This is going to bring nostalgia back and bring back Disney's animation studios. And, you know, I never thought about it. I didn't even know, honestly, this was a Disney movie. I didn't realize back then that Touchstone, makers of Adventures in Babysitting and Can't Buy Me Love and so many other movies I watched endlessly in my teen years when this came out, was a Disney company. And so I didn't ever equate Roger Rabbit with Disney, but in context, knowing what I know now, the success of this leads to The Little Mermaid, which leads to Aladdin, which leads to The Lion King, which leads to them buying the world.
Right. And Spielberg could have gone a different path, too. I mean, I think they were worried because he had hooked up with an ex-animator, Don Bluth, and Amblin was putting out The Land Before Time and American Tale. He could have gone and created his own animated studio. So I think they wanted to keep him in-house. Everyone wanted to work with Spielberg. And so, yeah, they gave him too much money. And they probably really worried about how profitable it was really going to be. But lucky for them, it ended up being the biggest movie of the summer and the second biggest movie of 1988. Surpassed only by Rain Man.
You know, this movie, I can probably credit it for making me aware of a lot of those things that you were talking about, Arnie. It's like, before this, I wasn't aware that Touchstone was a subsidiary of Disney and stuff like that. But thinking back on this, I knew so much about this movie going in because there were so many things on Sunday evening about the making of this movie before it came out. And people sitting around talking about it, clips of Spielberg talking about what they're doing, clips of Zemeckis talking about it, seeing animatics of what's coming out. There was so much pre-hype and behind-the-scenes footage of this movie that wasn't done yet. Moving up to it, I kind of came online as a moviegoer around this time. I was probably like 14 when this happened, and I was like, oh, there's a machine behind making movies. It's not just somebody decides to do something and it comes out. There's a Hollywood machine, like you were saying, Stuart. And that's about this time. It was like, oh, okay, I can kind of start to see how some of this stuff comes together. So when I think of Roger Rabbit, I really think about the soup to nuts making of a movie more than the movie itself.
I remember this movie coming out very clearly. I was, again, watching making ofs. I think I talked about this when we discussed Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in the 1989 retrospective series. I was watching a lot of making of stuff on television, and I remember I was reading Starlog for one thing because I was a big Trek fan, and they had a lot of stuff about the special effects here, interviews with Zemeckis, who they love from Back to the Future, and then I saw on television how they did some of this with the robotic arms. That I just have this burned in memory of seeing this puppeteered gun and then seeing a weasel animated over it and the weasel holding the gun, and it was the technological prowess. I didn't realize it was from the guy who did Back to the Future necessarily. I don't remember that. I don't remember knowing Christopher Lloyd was in it. I sure as hell didn't know who Bob Hoskins was, but I went because this was supposed to be a technological marvel.
And so you saw it in theaters, summer 88?
Opening weekend.
Oh, okay. See, I was never into this. I was never even drawn to it. I did not grow up with Disney animation. I guess that was the point. They were trying to get me excited about it. It never felt like a movie made for kids. I know that sounds weird because it's cartoons, but I always just lumped this in with that wave of baby boomer nostalgia that was going on, like particularly in music, like with that Big Chill soundtrack and Stand By Me, the California Raisins singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Everywhere you looked in 1988, the boomers were trying to say we're the greatest generation and all of our culture mattered. This wasn't cartoons as I knew it. They didn't have Saturday morning on here. There's no Scooby-Doo. There's no He-Man. This is like those old cartoons. I mean, like Mickey Mouse. I had never seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon. Why would I want to go see that? There just wasn't a lot about this that felt fresh and contemporary. Like, I could have gotten excited about an animated movie, but not this kind of animation. So I stayed away. I didn't go in 88 to see it. I had no interest. The reason why it stayed in my mind is I must have gone to McDonald's. They had a cup tie-in, and for the longest time, I just had a weasel cup just lying around in my lap. I don't know. I couldn't have told you a thing about what the movie was. I eventually rented it and remember thinking it was okay, but I couldn't tell you what the plot is or anything. I remembered nothing about this movie other than what you guys are saying. They pushed so hard to tell us we should care about the animated history of bringing Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse together on the same screen and the efforts that it took to make this seamless vision. That it is, above all else, a technological marvel.
Yeah, I mean, marketing really worked here because everything was telling me this is a must-see movie. The trailers didn't appeal to me. The plot didn't appeal to me. I went because I was told, like Avatar, the Avatar of its time, you had to see this film and you couldn't wait for VHS. And I was still watching cartoons at this point. I mean, keep in mind, I was 13 years old when this movie came out, and I'd come home from school and I'd watch DuckTales. Woo! I mean, it was just on. I'm not saying I paid close attention, but I liked Gizmo Duck and a little bit of the squirrels, whatever their names were.
Yeah, you love them. Chip and Dale.
Chip and Dale. I was 13. I'm more than 30 years older than that now, okay? Forgive me for thinking Chip and Dale's a male stripper.
Well, it probably, yes.
Even some other stuff, I remember watching Dennis the Menace. It was just on, you know? There was nothing on after school except cartoons. And so I was still watching cartoons. I was not horribly averse to seeing a cartoon movie. And I've always thought Roger Rabbit is just a Bugs Bunny ripoff. Watching it now, I think he's actually more of a Daffy Duck ripoff in a Bugs Bunny body. But I always just thought of him as, why did you need to make Roger Rabbit? Why couldn't this just be Who Framed Bugs Bunny?
And they did have those movies and would have them later. I mean, Space Jam and Looney Tunes Back in Action. They could have just plugged these characters in and said, let's bring them back like a Muppet movie or something. Let's sell our characters hard. Why have Roger Rabbit? Because this is a darker realm. Because there is a level of skeeziness that went over my head, frankly. Coming back to this movie, I knew about Jessica Rabbit. They had made such a big deal about her as a sex symbol that I knew that the movie was saucy for a cartoon movie. Like, that was something more than you were going to get in your average kids film. But I wasn't prepared for how much this really is a detective story, even above a cartoon movie.
What's funny is you're hitting my only memory of this movie. My memory of this movie was skeeviness and walking out feeling like I needed to take a shower and wash this movie off of me. And that was at 13.
I'm falling closer to Stuart's memories on this too, where it's like, I remember the hype for it. I also remember not being hyped for it, but also having baby boomer parents and younger brothers, so I'm caught up in the middle of this. My parents are going to take the family to go see this movie that 14-year-old jaded Justin doesn't want to go see, and walking out of it, I was just kind of like, heh, whatever, but maybe it was just my family, or maybe it was bigger than that, but this movie has just kind of always been around in my life. I haven't gone back and watched it a whole bunch, but its references are always out there at family events and stuff like that, so this is a movie that I've been caught in the middle of without my permission for years.
Well, one of the things that happened, I mean, we talk about it with the summer of 89 movies, was prior to the summer of 1989, there was only a couple big event movies. It wasn't like it is today, where there's two a week. If you wanted to see a big movie, Roger Rabbit was pretty much the only show in town. And again, Spielberg, that name meant something. It meant less in 1988. I mean, he had burned me with Harry and the Hendersons, Batteries Not Included. They had used his name, abused his name, to put out inferior fantasy films. I just remember thinking it was better than some of that junk, but no Raiders, no E.T., his best days seemed behind him. That was my memory of this movie. And I think they were right. There was a debate about all the way up until like the week before this movie came out. Are we putting it out as a Walt Disney film? Are we putting out as Touchstone, which is usually where we put our adult comedies? This is not a Disney film. It would be wrong to say Magic Castle, come on, kids, let's go watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
And that was a decision that was made by Eisner as well as Roy Disney, Walt's nephew, who took a big hand in running the Disney Corporation. They made one mistake. Robert Zemeckis got final cut, and Spielberg got a lot of creative control. And so Eisner and Disney were there saying, rein it in, rein it in. We can't have alcohol. And Zemeckis is like, this is my cut. I'm not backing down from this. And so that's why we got the movie we got, with the tea and a factor and the liquor and the smoking and the guns. This is not what Disney would go by. But what I remember, in addition to the melding of animation and live action, was I was told this was an event. Like, Halley's Comet had come around just a couple years before, mm-hmm. and this was almost as big. Warner Brothers and Disney cartoons are going to share the screen. Never been seen before, never would be seen again. Oh my God, can you believe that they came to terms? It was like Marvel and DC doing some crossover comics. You had to be there for it.
That right there, I remember giving me anxiety because, sure, I know Daffy Duck, Donald Duck, Bugs Bunny, Mickey Mouse. I know the main roster, But halfway through this movie, I'm trying to keep up in my head, like, oh, geez, is that character somebody I should know? Should I be impressed that they got that person in here? Like, Chili Willy. I'm like, is that somebody I should know? I just remember, like, trying to keep up with the name drops and the special cameo appearances, that it kind of ruined it for me at the time.
Again, I go back to the simple fact is they didn't invite our cartoons. This is a movie set in 1947 for the baby boomers that were children post-World War II and discovering the first cartoons.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would have been far more excited for the live-action Thundercats meets Transformers meets He-Man cartoon crossover than anything with Bugs Bunny and Donald Duck at this point. Because say what you will, DuckTales had some smart humor to it that was not found in most of the cartoons I watched when I was watching the Bozo Show on WGN weekday mornings.
I mean, they could have all been there. Again, if it's a cartoon town, all cartoons live there, they could have been more inclusive than they were.
They did try to be more inclusive. Not everybody said yes. Popeye, Tom and Jerry, Casper the Friendly Ghost, these are some of the names that were in the script and they couldn't get the rights to.
But again, all old characters, all 50 years old or not contemporary. They're going for a vibe. Why don't we talk about it? Arnie, give them the plot.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit takes place in a world where cartoons actually exist alongside humans. Cartoons on television aren't drawn, but rather cast with animated beings instead of humans. In this world, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and Betty Boop are all just actors who have studio contracts on screen, but hang out at the same bar off screen. This story takes place in 1947 Los Angeles and features slapstick toon star Roger Rabbit, voiced by Charles Fleischer. He's married to the sexy, buxom Jessica Rabbit, voiced by Kathleen Turner. Lately, Roger hasn't been acting so well, so studio head R.K. Maroon hires Bob Hoskins' character, P.I. Eddie Valiant, to investigate. Eddie hates Toons as one killed his brother Teddy, but he needs the dough and quickly discovers Jessica is having an affair of sorts with Marvin Acme, rich owner of the Acme Corporation that makes all that stuff Wile E. Coyote can't use. News of this relationship devastates Roger. But the next day, Acme is found murdered and Roger is the prime suspect. Investing this case is Christopher Lloyd's character, Judge Doom, aided by his pack of weasel enforcers. Doom meets out quick justice by dipping Toons in what he calls dip. No, not that nasty tobacco you put in your lip, but a mixture of chemicals that actually melt animated beings. Frightened, Roger turns to Eddie for help. Eddie is reluctant to get involved, but through circumstances forced to help the cartoon bunny. Jessica reveals to Eddie that she was blackmailed into her romantic interlude with Acme, and Roger's regular co-star, Baby Herman, says Acme's will may be involved. See, Acme owned Toontown, the borough where most Toons live, but he had always promised upon his death that he'd leave it for the Toons themselves to own. But with Acme's murder, no will has been found. Eddie's investigation causes him to bond with Roger and realize not all Toons are terrible. More, he discovers the real murderer is Judge Doom? Not with a name like Doom. See, Doom needs the land that Toontown is on to default to the city so that Judge Doom can profit off the construction of Los Angeles' first freeway. More, Doom is actually a Toon in human disguise. And even more, he's the Toon that killed Eddie's brother. Eddie, a former clown, performs an act that causes the weasels to literally die of laughter. Then Eddie fights Doom, who dies when a vat of dip pours on him. Acme's will is found, and Toontown is given to the Toons to protect, and Eddie and Roger are fast funny friends, as credits roll.
This movie starts with Roger Rabbit in his element, in a maroon cartoon, copyright 1947, in color. The loving recreations of the cartoons of the era are very well done. Something I couldn't have appreciated at the time, but what we get here with this something cooking, it didn't click with kids. When they test screened this movie, a lot of the teenagers that have been invited to the test screening walked out when they saw this opening 5 minutes. But it's actually kind of a highlight if you know what you're in for. They've actually done a very good job of referencing a Bugs Bunny Looney Tune.
Oh, I definitely found a new appreciation for the cleverness of this opening. It opens as if it's a short before the feature, and then all of a sudden we are in this new world where animation and real life people are intermingling and coexisting, and it was just the perfect way to introduce us to this world.
I loved Looney Tunes as a very young child, but I remember at 13 and at my current age, a loving recreation of childhood entertainment doesn't do anything for me. It's like, again, why isn't this Bugs Bunny? Why am I not just watching one of these Bugs Bunny shorts? Why am I watching this rabbit and this baby run around? It's a good introduction to how Toon World is and how these people are actors. I like the reveal at the end when Roger Rabbit doesn't have stars above his head. He has birds above his head and the director's upset and they yell cut. That's a great moment. Everything getting there to me is, I don't enjoy watching 5 minutes of this kind of animated slapstick at my age.
The influences, it took me looking at the bonus material to get it. But the guy that actually designed Roger Rabbit, the guy that's the head of all of the animation of this, Richard Williams, says that he pulled from a couple different things. Clowns, for one thing. I mean, what I didn't realize, but all the Looney Tunes characters are based on mimes and clowns, and that's why Roger Rabbit has red hair. He wanted to have that as a reference. There are Bugs Bunny cheeks on this rabbit. There is a Porky Pig bow tie on this rabbit. There is a Goofy pants on this rabbit. And of course, he's wearing Mickey's gloves. So he really is an assembly of both Warner Brothers and Walt Disney property characters. And Zemeckis wanted him to resemble Jimmy Stewart. That was his one note. He's like, you can design him however you want, but I want him to feel like Jimmy Stewart, who was in a rabbit movie, if you know Harvey, but he was just also of the same era of 1947, comedic, beloved, kind of has the reputation that Tom Hanks does now of just being a beloved figure and an average Joe.
I'm with Arnie when I'm 14. This isn't working for me. It looks like a modern cartoon drawn to look old.
Yes.
It's just not working on that level. And even today, the style of animation just reminds you of that late 80s, early 90s WB style that I really wasn't into.
Well, keep in mind, Spielberg was a big part of why Warner Brothers brought Tiny Toons back. That WB style you're talking about, that is a after effect of this movie's success.
Animaniacs, right?
Yeah.
That was his.
Yeah, I was never a huge fan of the style of Animaniacs. Yes, I liked the cartoon and all that, but like Tiny Toons, get out of here. That's exactly what this felt like to me at this time. I'm finding a new appreciation this time around. I don't know if it's that Roger Rabbit itself has been around for nay these 30 years and has become somewhat part of culture, or it's my age and I can appreciate the creativeness that they're putting behind this.
It's obvious now, but someone used the word Chaplin, and I'm like, of course that's what he is. This cartoon not only establishes the animation style and tries to get us to laugh and remember how cartoons used to be, but it also tells us that our main character is put upon. Try as he might to help this baby, he's going to be rewarded with knives being thrown at him and thrown into ovens and what have you. He has that Chaplin-esque quality of being a man who just can't make it in modern times. And they'll eventually have to cut out of the scene because, yeah, he screws up the take.
And this is where the movie starts getting a bit more interesting to me, is this mixture.
The baby, you gotta love Baby Herman. Yes, that is him goosing the script girl as he walks off set. He does the very provocative movement with his hand. I don't know if you caught that, but there are some R-rated Easter eggs in here. It goes up the skirt and the face he makes. Yeah, freeze frame. Again, it's why we don't do this with Daffy Duck and known properties. They're going to do things with these tunes that no studio head would allow.
Now, what I didn't realize, I've only seen this film once before, in theaters in 88, so I did not remember, and I might not have even caught at the time, that this was a 1940s period piece. It's such a stylized movie that I think it could have just rolled off me that everything was a little bit old-timey, you know? I mean, it's not like there were cell phones in 1988 and things that would have made huge differences. So I didn't catch that this was post-World War II during that golden age of animation.
I don't think I caught that either, but it just felt like something of Bugs Bunny's time. You know, growing up watching Bugs Bunny, all the cars look like this. So sure, that's what cars look like in real life.
And I grew up watching Bugs Bunny. I mean, I remember watching some cartoon that would play. Again, Bozo Show or all these animation blocks I'd watch. There was one about a frickin' bomb siren. It was a World War II, like there'd be a siren for a bomb drill where all the lights had to be turned off in the town so that the Germans or the Japanese couldn't see the lights in the city. I was watching these as a kid without even understanding until I was much older what they were really doing, why there was the siren and why they had to turn off the lights. And so I grew up watching that stuff. And so it didn't feel period to me any more than 1978.
Yeah, I agree. We think of it as the era of the cartoon. We don't recognize it. We probably don't have familiarity with noir. I mean, that's not a word that a 14-year-old kid is going to use about, yeah, you know, detective movies, Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep. Like, that's not the references we're going to have. But that is indeed the movie that they're going to make once we get out of this scene. And
I said it before, I'll say it again. I mean, we've talked about him in Super Mario Brothers, but who is Bob Hoskins and how is he leading this huge production?
They didn't want him for this gig. They ran out of money and they only had so much to pay for. They looked at a lot of different people other than Bob Hoskins that they would hope would be interested. Harrison Ford said no. Bill Murray said no. Eddie Murphy said no. Jack Nicholson said no. Robert Redford said no. Chevy Chase said no. Charles Grodin had better things to do. I guess Midnight Run was a big hit. But yes, Bob Hoskins is a big problem for me when I saw this movie. I'm like, this is not my conception of a leading man. He's short, got all that back hair. He'd never been in any movie I've ever seen. And yeah, I just wasn't a fan of The Long Good Friday and Mona Lisa. I didn't know his work. And he just didn't have the appeal of a child star. It was a resistance to why I didn't bond with this movie. If they had had Harrison Ford, I think I would have wanted to like it because Harrison Ford has associations with things I really like. Coming back to it as an adult now, I can see what Hoskins is doing is quite good. In fact, if you compare him with anyone in a Star Wars prequel, he's outpacing them. He is doing it long before anybody else did, working with animated characters and completely selling us on his interactions.
I always just assumed they really wanted Danny DeVito, and he was busy making Twins, and so they ended up with this lookalike. I remember a rumor that Bob Hoskins, Phil Collins, and Danny DeVito were going to make the Three Bears, and I'm like, A, you don't need to add any hair to Hoskins' back, and B, I can't imagine three actors who look more related than those three, especially since two of them are English.
Yeah, but Hoskins had been nominated for a Best Actor Oscar just a few years before. He wasn't a nobody. It's just he wasn't a star. He lived in London, and they were filming this over there in this rundown studio, the same one they were filming Superman 4, and Superman 4 would come by and make fun of them. And he's like, are you kidding? This is your movie? Because they didn't understand that the animation was coming later. They would see the set and be like, these robots look terrible. This is going to be a terrible film. And who is this Bob Hoskins? But he is a really big asset here. For me now, watching this film, he sells what this movie is, which is a noir detective film in the style that I like.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, at the time, he was pretty much invisible to me. He was just an older, middle-aged guy that I didn't recognize who was talking to the animated rabbit that I was more interested in watching. Coming back now, I almost feel bad that my entire knowledge of Hoskins' work is Mario Brothers and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, knowing that he has a much more legitimate body of work behind him.
Yeah, like Spice World.
I mean, again, Arnie, he's so unkind. He is an Oscar-nominated actor at this point. Highly celebrated. But here, can we agree he's good?
Here's what I'll say about Bob Hoskins is, at the time, I don't think I liked him. I felt much more in line with Roger Rabbit. I wanted Roger Rabbit. He didn't like Roger Rabbit, so I didn't like him. Mm-hmm. And you're right. If this had been Eddie Murphy, an actor who I loved, I was in theaters for Coming to America 1 week later, even though I was way too young. And if it had been Harrison Ford, I think I might have been more on his side. But being as he is, I didn't like him. Now I realize he is A, impeccable American accent. B, he really knows what this character is, and he is really able to interact with the things that aren't there well. Kudos to Zemeckis for the puppets and the various tricks they used on set to make this happen, but you can't discount the actor either. That said, when you get a movie that has Dumbo flying with his ears, and yet this movie is grimy and slimy, and this is your protagonist, it is a mishmash of oil and water, and the oil is just dripping off his back that I cannot reconcile.
Okay, then I got two words for you. Duck tits. This is Howard the Duck. This is that same, yes, it kind of looks like a cute kid's fantasy, and yet there is something perverse about it as well. And you love to hate or to love, not sure where you fall on it, but you are obsessed with Howard the Duck. I think that you could see this movie as a spiritual cousin.
Perhaps I see this movie as you see Howard the Duck then, because I just look at this and it's like neither fish nor fowl to me. I'm like, what are you doing? You're too cel-shaded to really play to adults who aren't nostalgic for this. Maybe it played well to boomers. I guess it did. It made a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you're too slimy to play to children. What are you?
It feels subversive. The idea that this is supposed to be for kids, and yet it's not, and we're seeing the dark side, that doesn't feel outside your sensibility. I'm surprised to see you clutching your pearls.
Yeah, I mean, again, 14-year-old Justin's right there with you, Arnie. I'm hearing everything you're saying, but to Stuart's point, like all those other people that he mentioned that were considered for the role, I can't see any of them doing this role and not making it more of their movie.
Right.
I think somebody like Bob Hoskins works here because it's not becoming a Bob Hoskins movie. It's a Roger Rabbit movie with a fine actor doing his role.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Is a big star might overshadow the Toons. And here, if anything, we're always wanting more of the Toons. We can't wait to see the Toons. We're not necessarily not caring about Valiant, but we're not here for him. He is not the star of this movie. And he's here because RK Maroon has invited him to take a gig, $100, follow Roger Rabbit's wife, get some dirty pictures. This is when I realize I wouldn't have seen this movie back in 1988, 1989 when it came out on VHS. This is Chinatown. I don't know if you know that movie. It's one of my favorites, but that is how Chinatown began. Jack Nicholson takes some salacious pictures, and it becomes a chain of events that leads to a scandal about Los Angeles and real estate.
And that was obviously no coincidence. They were looking at Chinatown as inspiration for this. Chinatown, a much more mature film. Again, I just wouldn't picture this double feature playing to the same audience.
Yeah, but again, that's kind of what's cool about it is that it's asking more than a cartoon movie normally would. If you want to still keep calling it a cartoon movie. Again, Touchstone, not Walt Disney. And certainly once you get to see Jessica, you know she's not a rabbit. She might be a Playboy bunny. And in fact, there was a penthouse centerfold that dressed up as Jessica Rabbit a few months after this movie came out. Disney was not happy about it. But this really, I remember reading in newspapers and all, like grown men having fantasies about having sex with this cartoon bombshell.
You know, I mean, I'm sure Jessica Rabbit was the sexual awakening of many a 13-year-old boy. I didn't get it at the time, you know, I mean, real women were just fine by me. I didn't need an animated woman to ogle over, but I can see it. I mean, I see what they're doing there. She just oozes sexiness here. Here's what got me, not that I would have cared when I was 14, but I had no idea that this was Kathleen Turner doing the voice.
I didn't even really know who Kathleen Turner was at that age. I hadn't even seen Romancing the Stone.
No.
So I never knew that was her voice. I think I talked about that when we reviewed Body Heat earlier this year. But I think I got hung up on 13 as to why a rabbit would be with a human. I think that was really bugging me.
Yeah. It was a joke in the novel because the detective was surprised, just like we all are, that if someone's named Jessica Rabbit and we've already met Roger, we would think that she would be the Minnie Mouse to his Mickey. But in fact, this is based on femme fatales of the 40s noir. I mean, Lauren Bacall, Veronica Lake, Rita Hayworth. If you watch those old black and white detective movies, you're going to see a vamp walking around like this. Nightclub singer is usually the role that they play. It's a combination of three. Kathleen Turner is doing the speaking voice. Amy Irving, Steven Spielberg's wife, is doing the singing voice. And then they brought in an actual burlesque dancer to rotoscope and just to watch for certain scenes. They did actually have a woman come out onto the catwalk and do some of the moves to inspire the animators.
I think it would have worked a lot better if they went with one of their earlier drafts where Jessica Rabbit was the murderer. If you're going to do a femme fatale, that's the thing about noir is, I mean, again, let's look at Body Heat with Kathleen Turner. I mean, I think that movie's perhaps why she was perfect for this role. She's got the voice, but she was a femme fatale who seduced a man and then killed people and ruined his life. So to have her be a femme fatale here, if she was the murderer, I'd have gone with it. The other person they were bandying about was having Baby Herman be the murderer, but that's the one I like least of all of them. But she's not really a femme fatale here. She's just a femme.
She's a foil. I mean, she's set up to be a suspect for much of the movie.
Yeah, she's guilty of patty cake. That's what we're going to find out. At this club, the Paint and Ink Club, which Eddie Valiant has gone to because he doesn't go to Toontown, but this is a place for humans to interact with toons. Betty Boop is here.
And this is the big Donald Duck, Daffy Duck piano duet. And you can't downplay the fact that piano keys are moving and piano stools are moving. I mean, this interaction between real world object and animation is going well. And, you know, Warner Brothers was very big. Daffy and Donald had to have the same screen time.
Yeah, I enjoyed this. They do play off each other well. And yeah, it was nice to see them. It didn't occur to me that copyrights and lawyers kept them apart ever. I probably wouldn't have understood that when the movie came out. But who knows? Maybe when Disney buys Warner Brothers, they will play together again.
Which just speaks to, once again, the fact that this movie wasn't made for 14-year-old us. It was made for the baby boomers, and they would get that right away. This would be a big thing for them to be seeing on screen, is Daffy and Donald on screen at the same time.
Yeah, not to mention the Betty Boop character, which comes from Max Fleischer. I didn't realize, but in every one of a Betty Boop cartoon, if you can find, her top for one frame goes off, and you get a titty shot. That is a Betty Boop trademark. They apparently did that in this scene, and it's been caught. If you have the Blu-ray, you can't see it. But if you have the VHS, it's there. When she is saying Jessica Rabbit is a lucky girl for having Roger, she makes a cute little move. That's the part to freeze frame. Also at this club, Marvin Acme. He is the one that is going to die. He is the one that goes to Jessica Rabbit in her dressing room. He briefly has an encounter with Valiant in which he squirts him with invisible ink, setting up a whole lot of contrivance for the plot. It is funny to finally think about a face associated with all of those Roadrunner devices. You know, Coyote so many times pulled out the Acme box and tried to get that Roadrunner. And this was the guy that invented all those novelty items.
Or at least brought them to market. That face doesn't say inventor to me. It says businessman. But same point. Yes, Acme has a face now, which for 50 to 60 years never did. It was just a company with a logo on the side of a box.
I would not be proud of that company. I mean, that's like saying you run Kmart. I mean, it's just not a good brand.
Patty cake. This is the scandal. How dirty are we to think of it? We only see Valiant creeping up to the window, snapping a photo. It certainly got Roger in a tizzy when he finally sees the negatives. But it is, I think, only patty cake. That's not a euphemism for something. That is not a suggestive description for some sexual position. They literally were just Baker's man.
Yeah, I think that in Toon World, that's some kind of foreplay activity is the thing. It is literally patty cake, but it means more to them.
It's not a euphemism, but it's played as if it is. So, I mean, it works both ways. They're trying to stay on this side of an R rating and telling the same joke, but visually it is them just playing patty cake.
And Valiant, I think he has some guilt about doing it. Roger Rabbit freaks out. He runs off, and this will be the night of the murder, and it makes it look very guilty. But I think Valiant, this is where we're starting to learn what his real problem is with toons. And we have this backstory where he was a detective in business with his brother, and they just have like one shot that kind of traces around his office. We see the Maltese Falcon is there. I thought that was kind of funny. And we see all these old photos about how they grew up in the circus, went to police academy together, and then eventually opened up a detective agency. And this brother was killed by a toon.
Is this too much backstory? I think there's too much going on with this. The fact that he was a clown with his brother, and then they became PIs together, and then he was killed by a Toon, and then we're going to conveniently find out that Toon is Doom. It's cluttered and messy storytelling.
No, I think it's very sophisticated. Like, they don't beat you over the head with any of it. You'll either notice it or you won't.
This could be a point of contention where I could see it either way, where they're trying to show us, oh, he's not just this grumpy old detective. He used to have a sense of humor. He used to have fun. He used to love Toons and clowning around. But what became of him is because a Toon killed his brother, and that's why he's the way he is.
Yeah, and it, again, harkens back to Chinatown. Jack Nicholson's character in that. Why is it called Chinatown? Because that's the part of Los Angeles he won't go in. Something bad happened to him there. That's a mystery that never gets solved in that movie. In this movie, we will know why Valiant doesn't like to go to Toontown. That was where a piano was dropped on his brother, and something very similar has happened at the Acme factory the next morning when he's pulled in by the police to investigate a murder, supposedly done by Roger Rabbit.
It's interesting that they get a PI for this investigation. There's a lot of cops there, and usually you see more animosity, but I always feel that it's up to Eddie to figure out this entire crime, and the police are pretty ineffective, especially when we meet Judge Doom, who, man, it's like Judge Dredd, right? He's judge, jury, executioner.
Well, I think all the human characters are kind of gross. I mean, I don't think he's any worse than anybody else here. We can suspect that he's a bad guy. That they don't do anything to disguise. I don't know that you would think that he's necessarily behind the murderer. What we know is that he is a judge so tough that if you are found guilty and are a cartoon, they have a way of killing you. You know, that's the thing about Toons is you can shoot them, you can shoot them out of a cannon, you can do a million things. They always come back. How many refrigerators have been dropped on Roger Rabbit's head? But they have something called dip, which is real. I mean, that is actually, when they talk about it, the cleaning solution they use to wipe down a cell. If they've drawn something badly and need to start over, they take turpentine, acetone, and benzene and put it together. That's what this dip is. This is the kind of chemical that can erase ink and paint.
Oh, yeah. I mean, acetone, that's nail polish remover. Benzene, I've used that to strip paint before. This is real common stuff.
And it's a nice little detail that they didn't need to put in there, but they did. And I think that goes to the world building that makes this whole thing a bigger picture.
I'll say at the age of 13, though, I did catch something. I was like, why does Judge Doom have to wear huge black gloves to get near this chemical? It's only dangerous to Toons. Why is he wearing all this protective gear? He's acting like it's a vat of acid. And I figured out the reveal before it got to the end of the movie that this dude was a Toon.
Really? I just thought Christopher Lloyd was being big. And I don't know that he had played a villainous character yet. So I just thought that he was a wacky supporting character like he's wont to do. And killing a shoe, it's not the worst thing in the world. I guess it's a squeaking shoe. We can feel a little bad for it, in part because it is voiced by Nancy Cartwright, soon to be Bart Simpson.
And again, though, he's killing this shoe for no reason. This shoe does not deserve to be put to death for squeaking.
Again, it tells us that this judge doesn't really like Toons. It's sending us off the trail. How could a Toon hate Toons this much? He has to be a human. He's like Valiant, only 10 times worse.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to show his character. I mean, it shows that he is ruthless, and like you said, he is the law. He's the judge, jury, and executioner. And yeah, we need to see somebody die. We need to see the dip work, and I suppose a cute puppy dog looking shoe is as good a character as any, but like, I can see that traumatizing kids under the age of 10.
Total credit to Christopher Lloyd here. At the age of 13, because of the hat, the performance, the bald head, I didn't recognize this as Doc Brown or Professor Plum from Clue. I didn't realize who he was. He really becomes a character in this. He has completely different body language. This and Uncle Fester are perhaps the two most un-Christopher Lloyd-like performances I've seen him do.
The false teeth help that transformation too, but he has recognizable eyes. I mean, if you recognize his eyes, you're gonna be able to pick Christopher Lloyd out of a crowd.
But he's wearing dark glasses too, which I think help hide that.
Yes, that's part of the mystery about his character, are his eyes and the fact that he doesn't blink and what's going on with him. We suspect a mystery, but all we know for sure is Roger Rabbit didn't do it, because look at the title. He's framed. He's innocent. And that's why Baby Herman comes to Valiant at his office and says, give my co-star a break. The line, by the way, comes straight out of the book. 50-year-old Lust and 3-year-old Dinky. That was the kinds of jokes you get a lot in the Who Censored Roger Rabbit novel.
It's bawdy for sure. And again, at 13, I think I was finding a lot of this funny. Now, I think it's certainly boundary pushing. I'm not amused, but I'm interested.
We keep going back to at the time and stuff like that, but at the time, a lot of these jokes felt old-fashioned, stodgy. Now they feel kind of vintage and nostalgic, which is a weird turn to take, but, you know, we were looking at jokes from 40 years prior at the time. Now we're looking at jokes that are almost 80 years old, and it feels a little bit more storybooky fantasy land about it than at the time, where it just felt like, oh, these are my grandma's jokes.
Yeah. It is pushing boundaries, and I do feel like if I had small children, I wouldn't want them to be watching this. I can understand a hesitation in pushing this on kids. If I were running Walt Disney Studios, Jessica Rabbit is no Disney princess. I would not put the doll out there. It's not something that you'd want children to dress up as for Halloween.
And Baby Herman gives us our MacGuffin for the movie. You'd think the MacGuffin is Roger himself, as he's the one the police are after, but it's actually this will, like I talked about in the plot summary. Acme had a will. Acme, he was successful enough to own all of Toontown, and this is before Jim Crow laws, so there were, I guess, all the Toons were still segregated into that slum.
Yeah, it does definitely could be read as a social statement. I do think that there is applicable metaphor to the way that this Toon is a ghetto, and yeah, the way that blacks and brown people have been marginalized in slums.
But we're just past the half hour mark. It's time to switch to Act Two. This is where Roger Rabbit comes to Eddie for help, because I guess Roger has no other friends in the world than this PI who showed him his wife was playing patty cake with other men.
You know what's interesting is when you watch the behind the scenes footage, Charles Fleischer is the voice of Roger Rabbit. I think he does it very well. He gives him a very distinctive sputter, but he really committed. Like, he was there on set, dressed as closely as possible as a rabbit in this outfit. And you can just see him standing off screen, saying all the lines in character, and really commit. That was also why the Superman 4 people were laughing, like, that's your rabbit? That'll never work.
And Charles Fleischer, an actor who I only really know for being the Dream Doctor from A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 1.
Huh? Too deep for me. I don't remember him that. What did he do?
He's the one who's like with the mother smoking a cigarette in the hospital. What are dreams?
Oh, okay.
Mysteries we don't really know.
Yeah. Okay. Charles Fleischer is mostly known for this. This is his moment.
And it really feels like even at the time he had a chip on his shoulder about that. Every behind the scenes footage I've seen with him, and even being 14, I feel like I kind of got this vibe off of him that he thought he was too good for this. Like, he knew he was good at it, but he felt like he was destined for bigger things as an actor.
Yeah, what I found interesting is Charles Fleischer is not a voice actor by large. You know, they didn't get Mel Blanc to do this.
Although he came back, it should be said, anybody that used to voice the old Toons, they invited back. The Betty Boop that did it originally was back. You know, these people are old, so they don't even sound the way that they normally did.
Right, I know that all those people came back, and it's good to note them, but it's not like this guy was one of them. What I'd learned from, like, when Star Wars The Clone Wars was on, and I was doing a deep dive interviewing those people, is there's a stable of voice actors that are amazing voice actors and can do so many voices, and then somehow Casey Kasem got into that rank too and cannot do many voices but Casey Kasem's. But this guy isn't one of those voice actors. He is trying to be a real actor. He was, again, Nightmare on Elm Street and various TV shows. Now here he is in the bunny suit. I think that's why he tried to go method. You know, he wasn't just trying to do a voice. He felt like, well, I need to get into this character and I need to become something more.
Yeah, and he deserves props. I think that he does give this animated bunny an extra something. There is something. I don't think that Roger's lovable. He's too neurotic for that. I mean, he's too destructive, but I feel for him. Again, Chaplin, the way that his bad things just keep happening to him. And he doesn't even mean to, but like, you know, just ends up getting cuffed to the detective and the weasels are coming and you just, he's put upon.
You say Chaplin. I love Chaplin. You know where I might love Roger Rabbit? If he was silent. He is this constant droning whine in this movie. I like the animation and I like the characterization, but Charles Fleischer, he's perfect for this, but I don't want what he's selling.
Well, that's an interesting position to take. He's great for somebody else. I mean, yeah. That sounds like a breakup line.
It's not him, it's me.
Okay. So you're saying he's good and you don't like it?
Yes.
Okay.
I like the weasels a lot more. It's a directing choice. It's a writing choice to make Roger Rabbit this nonstop screech. Later on, Judge Doom is going to do fingernails on chalkboard type thing. And that is Roger Rabbit to me.
Okay. I mean, I like it. I think it's endearing. I actually think this movie needs something toony because all the tunes here are just a little bit dirty. This feels like the one thing that the kids can focus on that you don't feel like a bad parent for letting them see.
I can see the voice becoming annoying, but at the same time, you have the challenge of creating a new animated voice amongst this cast of legendary animated voices. So I think his performance had to be this big and over the top to stand out over the legends that he's standing next to.
And again, money. I mean, they were over budget on this thing. They got a younger guy that could grow with this role when they make all the sequels and everything. You don't want to go with a classic actor who's 78 and how long have they got anyway? I mean, Mel Blanc has the bulk of those kinds of roles and he doesn't need another. Weasels. Let's talk weasels. The Toon Patrol. I didn't get it until I saw it in the supplemental material. They were trying to do a riff on the dwarves. Snow White had 7 dwarves in the original script. These were 7 defective. They have names like dwarves, but it's Smartass, Stupid, Greasy, Psycho, and Wheezy. And then the 2 that got cut were Slimy, because he was covered in snot, and Sleazy, which I can only imagine what he's covered in.
If there had been 7, then that parallel would have worked. By cutting 2 of them, it just becomes a weasel gang, and I find them all interchangeable.
Sure, you might hear the names, but you're not going to tell one from the other, except for the psychopath one. He's in a straitjacket. That one I can spot.
That one looked different, and I think one was voiced by Squiggy of Lenny and Squiggy fame that kind of stood out. He was the leader.
Yeah, he's the one that's going to march into this office, and Eddie has a choice. Is he going to turn this rabbit in? He doesn't really like him, but he went back to the old photographs, and he saw sticking out of the pocket of Acme while he was playing patty cake. There was that will. There is a deed that's being covered up, and that's what he really wants to solve. It's not that he wants to save Roger. It's that he wants to figure out what happened to the will and who played him. He was set up to take those photos, and he doesn't like to be made to feel like a chump. So for that reason alone, he's going to hide him in the dishwater while the weasels tear up the place and take him over to his friend Dolores, who is running the bar, used to be with him at the detective agency, and has, since it's an old speakeasy room, a secret place to stash the Toon refugee.
And this is, again, a old trope of the put-upon girlfriend. It did remind me quite a bit of the relationship we discussed. It would be 2 years after this. Dick Tracy, where Warren Beatty had that longtime girlfriend who kept getting older and they never got married.
Tess Trueheart. I mean, this is known as the Madonna whore complex. You have the femme fatale that represents all the sin and lust, and then you have the girl you get married to who is honorable and dutiful and unchallenging. And yes, Dolores is the flip side of Jessica Rabbit, although Valiant will not have an affair with Jessica. That's out of character of the genre.
They'll save that for Cool World.
Yes. And yet she will come to him, Jessica, very abruptly. A very important scene gets cut here in the middle, but Jessica shows up at the office soon and is really putting her hooks into Eddie, and it's where she has her famous line, "I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way." Came from the book.
Movie's most disturbing scene, Hoskins with no shirt on.
Yeah. He doesn't look like a leading man. Now I can just see he does look like a toon himself, like a teddy bear or something.
Yes, literally. He's as furry as a teddy bear. I now think instead of Phil Collins and Danny DeVito, we need to bring in Dan Hedaya here. This guy is got a fur sweater. It is creepy. And then he takes his pants down, too. I mean, they fall down, but Jessica Rabbit causes his pants to fall down. That's more Hoskins than I ever needed to Bob.
Yeah, he fully commits. I mean, Hoskins, again, that's why I want to really salute him here. Apparently, he got so deep, his wife got worried because he couldn't break from it. They shot this movie for over half a year. So every day, he's talking to things that weren't there. He would go home, and that pattern would continue. Finally, the wife was like, if you talk to that chair one more time, I'm going to call the medics, and you're going to be hauled away. Like, she couldn't take it anymore. But he really did lose himself in this part. And hey, why not? I mean, that's a level of commitment that I have to celebrate. But there was an important scene here. Why is Jessica here? What was going on? The private eye had gone back to where he photographed. And he was trying to look for the will. And that's where he meets Doom and Jessica. They're plotting seemingly together. And it's why you might start to suspect her, is that she seems to be knowing things that she shouldn't. And this is where she first gets the idea that Valiant is on the case. That's why she knows to make him her mark.
And this is confusing plotting to me, though, that she was blackmailed by Maroon, who said he would hurt Roger's career if she didn't play Patty Cake with Acme, and yet Doom's the one behind all that. It gets a little confusing.
It's all there, and again, it's all Chinatown. If you really want to understand all these relationships, this is a condensed version of all the twists in save for one.
It is confusing on a first viewing and at the onset, but once we know the full plot, all you really need to know is that Doom is the one pulling all these strings. They even talk about it later on that he bought up the Red Cab Company just so he would be able to profit off selling the land for the freeway. He's got his hands in everything, and you don't need to know all the details. Just know that he's the one pulling all the strings.
And when you look at the history of California, what's really interesting is all this stuff is true. The conspiracy that they uncover in Chinatown and the one here are based on real events, that the car industry did conspire to end public transportation in Los Angeles so that people would buy cars. I now can't imagine a Los Angeles that has a good public transportation system. It's funny that they have these red trolleys running throughout the town, but that was the way it worked. I think it was a little earlier than 1947, but yeah, once the automobile became the wave of the future, Ford, General Motors, all those guys did put them out of business.
And we find out, remember, Doom was the toon that killed Teddy, Eddie's brother. He did that during a bank robbery where he stole, what was it, 1 million simoleons?
These details roll right off of me. I have no idea why it's not really that important.
Well, that's how Judge Doom is financing everything. That's how he got to buy all the land he bought, was with the stolen simoleons. And why he's in human disguise is because they're looking for the toon that robbed the bank.
You're right. That does tie something together I hadn't considered. But I think this is not a movie where we need to spend obsessing over the plot twist and details to see if it all makes sense.
But if it's a good noir film, it should.
To a point, yes.
If this was an all live action noir film, you would demand it makes sense.
No. The Big Sleep makes no sense, and it's still a great Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall movie.
But when we did Body Heat, you called out how muddy that one's plot reveals are at the end with the blackmailing scheme.
Let me follow suit. You can enjoy a noir where the mystery never makes sense if you're entertained with the chemistry. It's not really about, I mean, the word MacGuffin refers to the fact that you are supposed to care about what everyone's trying to find, this Maltese Falcon. But really, it's all about the snappy dialogue. It's the sexual chemistry. It's the danger and the black and white cinematography. That's why we're here. We're not here to understand how Toontown is a metaphor for the changing landscape of Los Angeles. I mean, that's all supplemental. That's all nice detail work to appreciate on further viewings. But this movie's going to live or die whether you like to see an animated rabbit push over live action props.
And let's not forget, the title is Who Framed Roger Rabbit? That's the overlying mystery, which does pay off. And there we have a few misdirections throughout. So yeah, getting caught up in little tiny details doesn't necessarily lead you anywhere, nor does it take away from my enjoyment of what's happening. And at the same time, I don't need a final twist at the end of this movie where they go back and show us plot reveals. It's like, oh, you missed this, you missed this, you missed this, and that's why this happened. It's not that type of movie. This is more of a straightforward whodunit. But Arnie, you said you figured it out pretty early on, so maybe that's why the ride isn't as fun on your side.
I mean, his name's Doom. There's not a whole lot of mystery there.
But it could be Jessica Rabbit, too, because she's a femme fatale. I mean, it's not a guarantee. And in fact, you're arguing it should have been her because it would have been so obvious. If you're trying to make it about who did the murder, then you're kind of saying I'm not into the vibe of this movie. I mean, that's you admitting that what they're offering is not of interest.
I said that already.
Yeah. So when Roger is on top of the bar doing a can-can to the old Looney Tunes theme, you're wanting to know, when are we going to find out who killed Acme?
I found the next half hour of this film, all of the car chasing with the talking cab and the talking bullets and all of this where we're not really developing plot, but we're merely moving things forward. We're past the hour mark, and the novelty of cartoons interacting with real world items, sometimes poorly. Those weasels never point the guns in the right direction, not once. But the novelty's wearing off, and I find myself wanting it to move faster than it does.
Only if you're not having a good time.
And I can feel a little bit of where you're coming from. I mean, I feel like there's scenes in this movie, which, to the credit of the movie, was a standout. Like, Stuart, you brought up, when we've had live action mixed with animation before, it was a static background and an animation drawn over a film. We're getting dynamic movements here. We're getting car chases and cameras on tracks and all kinds of technologically almost impossible things at the time this movie is being made. And I can see where sometimes they revel in it a little too much and a little too long. But where this really does not work for me is when we actually go to Toontown and it's the reverse. And we have live action over animation. To me, it looks junky and it does not age well.
Oh, see, it's my favorite part. I'm going to make the complete opposite stance that I think that the world that they built is fine, but they've teased Chinatown. I can never go there. I'm not going there. I hate Toons, all of that stuff. Well, of course, we've got to go there. I mean, of course, the climax has to be built to going there, and they've really got to deliver it. It's got to be the craziest place since Oz. You know, there's a little bit of setup to get there. R.K. Maroon, he more or less admits Doom is the bad guy at this point, and he gets killed, and we think it might be Jessica because she's caught running away. This is why he's going into Toontown. Valiant knows the only way to get Jessica is if he faces his demons. It's what you would always want to see a main character to do. You face your past, something you're running from, and now is the climax of the film.
Even as a kid, I don't think I ever liked the man-hungry, ugly woman cartoon trope. And when they bring that in here, that's perhaps the skeeviest thing in this movie to me.
Oh, that's hilarious. He sees the silhouette in the building. I mean, that's such a classic. Runs up there. Hello! Come on. You got to enjoy this.
Oh, man! Even as a kid, I did not like those cartoons. I always found them skeevy. And also, Pepe Le Pew was a little rapey. I didn't know the word rapey as a kid, but I knew Pepe Le Pew was not right.
He needed to learn boundaries, that's for sure. But, I mean, what you're saying is, if you're not a fan of retro cartoon styling, and it sounds like you're very much not, this movie is not going to be any fun at all.
Not just retro cartoon styling. If you're not a fan of hearing jokes that you heard 50 years ago and going, wait, that was funny, I'm going to laugh again.
Well, we all do that. You can't tell me that comedies you love also aren't built on vaudeville and old-time jokes. I mean, we retell jokes since we've had instruments to write them down. I mean, it is a common device that we use to entertain generation after generation.
I agree. I also think humor is one of the things that ages the worst. Humor is usually based upon mocking affairs of the current day or pushing boundaries. Neither of those age very well. When I go back and try to rewatch Cheers or Night Court, which I loved at the time, Family Ties, they don't hold up. And here, I don't think if you weren't alive in 1951, these jokes would be funny. I think they're outdated by the time this came out in 88.
I mean, I think they're funny now, so obviously I can't agree with you. Droopy in the elevator, that's a great bit.
Okay, I love Droopy Dog. Droopy Dog is absolutely my favorite cartoon character from that, and I do love him in the elevator.
Okay, good. All right, at least we can agree on that. Like, Tweety coming out and lifting the guy's fingers as he dangles off. And then, of course, the classic shot, the one that we will never see again. I mean, who knows? But Mickey on one side, Bugs on the other, and Valiant falling off the building. He wants a spare parachute, and he gets a spare tire, and you know, ain't I a stinker? I mean, it's nice that not only do the characters come together, but they still retain their personalities. This is exactly what Bugs Bunny would do when someone is falling off a building. He's sadistic.
I love this part, and let me clarify what I'm saying about Toontown. It's not that the plot falls apart for me and I don't think he should be there. I'm saying this is where it, on a technical level, falls apart for me. It looks very green screened with Bob Hoskins over the animation. He's too dark in front of everything else. I don't think the technology was there for them to do this properly. I think if they redid this now, or they George Lucas did and did a special edition and cleaned it up, it would probably be fine for me. But it just looked bad from a few angles.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I mean, yeah, it's obviously blue screen work, but they try really hard to still, I mean, he's still being manipulated on that blue screen. They're doing their best to make it seamless with the other parts of town in Los Angeles. I just like all the bits. I think they're all funny, and it's kind of over very quickly. Before you know it, some dip is thrown on the road. Benny the cab spins out. Jessica flashes us. If you have that VHS copy, you can actually see the dress go all the way up. And Doom is taking us to the climax.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that, right? Like, over the years, Disney animators sneaking dirty stuff in. I know there was a single frame in The Rescuers where there's like a topless picture of a woman on somebody's wall as they're flying by.
I have the video box for the first edition of Little Mermaid, and that is a penis castle.
I remember when that got revealed, a lot of people were very upset.
People get mad at Disney, you know, in general. I mean, I don't know how it is now, but they were known to be not free with their money, and a lot of people felt cheated and got their revenge where they could. And so that's why we have this long history of people sneaking stuff in on the wholesome Disney entertainment. But once Disney became aware of each of these incidents, Betty Boop was not allowed to flash us, and Jessica's skirt stays relatively modestly to the ground as she's flung to the ground. We're at Acme Factory. She's tied up with her husband, reunited, and we find out that Doom has a Doom machine. It's a tank full of dip, and he's going to use it to completely wash away Toontown at midnight when he officially has the property, unless they can find that will.
If we're supposed to believe Toons are people, are we also supposed to believe that legitimate law enforcement is going to turn their back at the annihilation, the genocide of the Toon people?
Well, you can look at the history of racial politics and race riots in this country and see where blind eyes were turned. Yeah, I would say, yes, cops have looked the other way when injustice like this happens.
And to the movie's credit, they do kind of set that up. They kind of set the cops up as indifferent towards Toons. They're on the scene as duty dictates, but they don't seem to be invested in what they're doing on the crime scenes when it's involving a Toon.
Right. And this is where we also get the reveal about, well, first they got to kill the weasels. I don't really get this. Laughing the death, I'm not sure. I think that might be a reference to some old cartoon. I seem to remember maybe Tex Avery drew something where weasels did do this. For some reason, I have a sense of deja vu when I see them just fall over laughing and grow angel wings and float up into the sky. But I don't know what that reference is.
There were a number of Bugs Bunny cartoons and things where the spirit would leave the body and he'd have the wings and the harp.
Definitely.
And I remember laughing to death being a turn of phrase, but I don't remember a specific cartoon where that occurred.
But beyond their death, which frankly, we didn't know them enough. You're right. They don't work as the parody of the dwarves that they need to be. This is where we really find out what Doom really is and how self-hating he is as a Toon. Those eyes. That is something kind of freaky. Hopping around on that pogo stick and those bulging Tex Avery eyes.
That worked really well. The animated eyes on the body. I'm surprised how well that really worked compared to everything else. And when the daggers come out and everything, the spring feet go-go gadget, whatever, was okay, but those eyes really are creepy on that Christopher Lloyd face with that tuft of hair. He kind of looks like the baby, right? I mean, with the bald head and the tuft of hair and the cartoon eyes.
Yeah, they wanted Tim Curry for this, but apparently he came in and read for it. And literally, Steven Spielberg was like, he was too scary. Like, he scared me. I couldn't handle this. They got Lloyd because people associate him with comedy. They think he's funny. But I think this has the potential to make small children cry.
Oh, yeah. No, this is over the top creepy. And I don't know what Tim Curry could have done that was even more creepy than this, because this is a nightmare juice right here. Like you said, the big bulging eyes, the weird tuft of hair, the big teeth. It all just adds up to, I'm probably not going to sleep well that night if I'm 8 years old.
And keep in mind, all these filmmakers, Spielberg and Zemeckis and all, grew up being terrified of Wizard of Oz. So, like, this is their homage to that. If it's a kid's movie that gives you nightmares, they've done their job, and we're going to even melt him down into a yellow puddle once the dip gets released from his machine.
I preferred him being run over by the machine and flattened. I thought that was a good end. But yes, what has been said is you can't kill a tune. That's why you have to have the dip. I mean, you see all the abuse Roger and every Looney Tunes cartoon has ever undergone. Why is the coyote still alive? You can't kill a tune. That's why you have to have the dip. And so, yes, we got to dip the judge.
Yeah, and in a movie like this, the climax has to take advantage of the medium. And if we're to believe we're in an animated world, then we have to do some of these tropes that we've been seeing for years in animated films or just cartoons in general. And to see these done with live action characters, I think is somewhat of an accomplishment that it doesn't come off too goofy or hokey looking.
What do you think about the original ending? Because this is where they were going to use Casper the Friendly Ghost. Roger dies. Roger does something to sacrifice himself to stop this tank of dip and is washed away and dies for everyone. And they go to a funeral where Casper the Friendly Ghost and I guess any creepy cartoon would be hanging out. And that was how the movie was scheduled to end. Instead, it's Porky Pig. That's all, folks. They go with a song and dance number. But as fine a line as they've walked with having adult boundary-pushing moments, I'm not sure this movie would have been a hit if it had ended on that sour note.
Zoinks! No, no way. That is too far. You want a happy ending for a cartoon. You want to see Roger get back with his Jessica, assuming Jessica is not the killer.
Yeah, I mean, that ending would have cemented this as a potential cult classic at best. And nothing more. It would have put it solidly in adult fare only,
mm-hmm.
and not something that could be on the line of family fare.
The movie that killed Walt Disney Studios, probably. Yeah, I'm not sure they could have survived spending that much money on a movie that underperformed the way that I think a movie that this could have been, would have been. I think it's a carryover from the original novel. I think it was in earlier drafts when they still hadn't quite worked out all of the super edgy adult humor out of the story.
And this is where the will comes in, too. Acme had some disappearing ink that he sprayed on Eddie earlier, and we find out that Roger had written Jessica a love letter trying to woo her back. And what was it on? It was on the will, which was written in disappearing ink that would reappear after however long this movie is in their time.
Exactly.
I love the battle here at the end. Like, I couldn't believe it's a Touchstone movie, and yet Porky Pig is going to get the final moment.
You and Eisner both. Eisner actually said to Zemeckis, wait, this is a Disney film and you're ending on Porky Pig? And Zemeckis was like, all right, I'll do you this one.
Yeah, for no good reason at all, Tinkerbell gets the last moment. If no other reason, I guess she's a Disney princess and Disney is going to end on Disney.
Well, Justin Stewart, do you recommend Roger Rabbit? Justin.
You asked 14-year-old Justin that question. The answer comes back, nah, I don't care. Whatever. That's about all I cared about this movie back then. Coming back and watching it, sitting down and spending time with this movie all these years later, I kind of like having a nostalgia for a movie that was made to cash in on nostalgia from before that. I will say this. I think it deserves a place in history for what it tried to do and mostly accomplished. You know, this had not been done to this scale before. There's a lot of big names working on this to make it happen. And Zemeckis stood by his guns and ended up releasing the movie that he wanted to make. So with that knowledge in mind, I think it's a success. I'm also very glad that this did not become a franchise. I'm glad that Roger Rabbit didn't have a 1, 2, 3, and 4. It didn't need that. I think this was a snapshot of a moment in time before we started getting to what Pixar would become. You know, I mean, Space Jam came out years later and did the same thing. That's got fans that follow it and stuff.
And there's a sequel on the way with LeBron James now. It could be our next franchise if you want it.
Sure. But Roger Rabbit, I think, lives in this time where it's not a huge hit, but it lives on. Like, both my kids are aware of it. They know who Roger Rabbit is. He's never going to be a toy that everybody has to go out and get. He's not going to be Bugs Bunny. He's not going to be a Disney character. But he did have a big life. I mean, they had attractions at Disney and MGM Studios that were Roger Rabbit themed. This whole warehouse was a part of MGM Studios for a long time. So I'm glad we came back and did this. I found a new appreciation for Roger Rabbit. So I don't know if I can recommend it for everybody, but I think if you're in our age group and you haven't watched it since it came out and haven't thought much about it, I think it's worth revisiting because there is a good movie here and I can appreciate it for what they were trying to do. So yeah, it's a green arrow for me.
Stuart.
Yeah. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Robert Zemeckis. He framed it as a showcase for letting my generation know that animation and cartoons could be cool on the big screen. We didn't know that. We didn't grow up with it. Disney was in the tank, and this was an attempt to show what he loved about cartoons. His interpretation of his childhood, a combination of noir and classic tunes. I think it works for that time. As you say, I think it doesn't work as the kickoff to a character that was going to go solve new mysteries. I don't think we'd want to see Bob Hoskins and Roger Rabbit try to crack another case. They solved what needed to be solved. Disney Studios was broke. And the next year, they would have Little Mermaid. And the year after that, they would keep going. Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. They didn't need Roger Rabbit. And Jessica Rabbit is no Disney princess. You would not pimp her stuff in the Disney store. It's just not a good fit for where they decided to go. But if you do like subversive live-action cartoons, if you do like Howard the Duck, I do think there's a lot of wit here. What I recommend is come for the noir, stay for the cartoon. I actually, because of my love for detective fiction, and specifically Chinatown, had a really good time, more than I expected to. And I think it's a solid movie that, yes, is a technical marvel, but also is an enjoyable throwback to a genre I really like that isn't cartoons, noir.
And here I'm just going to sit diametrically opposed. I also like noir films quite a bit. Maltese Falcon, we talked about Body Heat. I really enjoy that genre. And this one does not work for me. What I love about noir films, what I think makes a noir film, is atmosphere. What this movie does not have is that noir atmosphere because it's punctuated by Charles Fleischer pleasing all over the place. I think he breaks the atmosphere. I can't wallow in it the way I can a Blade Runner. And while it was technologically marvelous for its time, watching it now, all I can notice is how washed out it looks on the Blu-ray. Everything, I mean, because it was post-processed and everything had to be run through machines and it was film, there was a degrading that is noticeable to me in every frame where there's a shot of animation.
Yeah, and it was amazing. Sometimes they'd have to stack the cells so high it was 8 feet. There was so much animation going on. It was an 8 foot tall shot.
Wow. I mean, it's incredible for a pioneer for its time to remember they did this without computers. This was all hand drawn animation. They filmed this thing, they edited this thing, and then they handed it to animators and said, go draw. And you couldn't change anything because the edit was now done because they were drawing on it.
For 55 minutes of the movie, more than half of this movie has animation going on in it.
And just as talented as the animators were the lawyers who got all these characters together. I think it's a legal achievement. I think it's a technological achievement. I didn't like it then. And coming back, my question was I too young? Did I not get it? Here's what's really funny is you say Howard the Duck, but you hate Howard the Duck. And I love Howard the Duck.
Right. So why do you like the bad movie?
So why do you like the bad movie?
It is. Wait, are you telling me that Howard the Duck does this better?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
I think it does. I think it has a more consistent tone. I think it has a better villain. I think it has a better climax.
A better villain.
Yes. To be fair, I red arrowed Howard the Duck. I know that movie sucks. I know it's not good. Just because I have a guilty affinity for it because it's based in my childhood, much younger than Roger Rabbit, doesn't mean that I approve of what it is.
Sure, I get that. But one movie you definitely celebrate its bad taste and one seems to repulse you. So yeah, I really hoped I'd come back and discover something that as a kid I didn't get. I didn't. It's a not recommend. I know I'm in the minority. I just feel so dirty in this film. I feel the grime of this film washing off on me in a way I do not like.
Well,
you're right. Most everyone else did enjoy it. It won 3 Oscars that year. Visual effects, editing, sound effects, editing, whatever the hell that is. Beating out Die Hard, Beetlejuice, Willow. Just want to point out what it was up against. And the plan was, we're going to do a sequel. In the meantime, let's put out some animated shorts. Let's do a few more Maroon Toons. One was attached to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. One was attached to Dick Tracy. And one was attached to some kid's wilderness picture no one remembers called A Far Off Place.
Okay, I'm not alone. I was looking at this. I'm like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Saw it in theaters. Dick Tracy. Saw it in theaters. So I saw both of those. What is this A Far Off Place? I even looked it up and I'm like, I know the actors' names who have been in this, but I don't know this movie.
Yeah, here's the thing. You know, they are just like the start of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It is just the same plot, the same mechanics. Roger is always trying to help the baby. The baby is always unwittingly starting problems, swallowing rattles or chasing red balloons at carnivals or turning a camping trip into, I think, nuclear war or something by the end of it. But it would be fun to watch this as the start of a different kind of movie, but watching them back to back, it lessens the effect. It dulls the blunt of the joke to see the same setup again and again. Just as sitting there and watching Looney Tunes back to back is less fun than just seeing one before the start of a different movie.
Yeah, just to play it as a straight animated cartoon doesn't work. It's just more noise in an already crowded animated world. But can we talk for a second about what exactly is the relationship between Roger and Baby Herman's mother?
Yeah, I know. Like, she's always threatening to, like, take him back to the science laboratory or, you know, it was hunting season when they go camping. And, like, there is a sadistic side, but I seem to remember this. This is the setup of Sylvester and Tweety. Sylvester was trusted to not eat the bird and always betrayed the woman in the house that left him alone.
Right, but they were Granny's pets, per se. Is Roger her pet? Is he her nanny for the baby? Like, she is always going at him like they're an old married couple.
A married couple where she's threatening to cook the husband.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a little strange, admittedly. Maybe it would have been explained in future. There was a plan for a fourth one. Hair in My Soup was going to be attached to Toy Story. You mentioned Pixar. They thought that Pixar's needed a little lift. They were going to do a fourth Roger Rabbit. The only reason it didn't happen, well, Spielberg was not going to run Disney. He was going to run DreamWorks. And he wasn't interested in giving other movie studios content or working for all of that. He had the rights to the character, and they said no. So we didn't get more Roger Rabbit because of him. And I think it's why we didn't get a sequel. I mean, they had lots of scripts. I read one was supposed to be set in World War II. It was a prequel and on the battlefield. There was one after Bob Hoskins died where they were just going to animate him as a ghost and continue on. A lot of strange ideas. I think it would have happened, honestly. Bad or not, I think they would have made the sequel because you just always make the sequel to the hit movie. But because of Spielberg taking away Jeffrey Katzenberg from Disney to go form a new movie studio, they were the ones that really love Roger the most, and they said nobody else can have him.
I really think it's a happy accident that things didn't line up for a sequel, because I do think that would tarnish what this movie accomplished in the way that Arnie is saying that it already did to itself.
And as recently as during the press junket for Welcome to Marwen movie that Zemeckis did.
Oh boy.
Zemeckis was talking about a sequel with Eddie in ghost form, the digital Bob Hoskins for it. He loves the script. Spielberg's on board. The reason it's not happening, his exact quote is, "The current corporate Disney culture has no interest in Roger, and they certainly don't like Jessica at all."
Exactly. How could they promote that in the way that they promote their other Toon stuff?
It's a property with no home.
Yeah.
And yet it's weird because Roger Rabbit cosplayers were on Disney lots. There were, as Justin mentioned, Disney events with Roger Rabbit. It's like they incorporated him until they didn't need him. The same way that they kept Nightmare Before Christmas at arm's length until it became a hit, and then all of a sudden, oh, you're Disney now.
Yes, I agree. They don't respect what this property did for them, and
it's the first wife that was left behind when Disney got successful.
Yeah, thank you, next. I mean, like, there seems to be a sentiment of, like, oh, I'm just so grateful, but I got my own thing. And so, yeah, all right. It probably is for the best. I do not want a sequel.
It's funny that you mentioned Ariana Grande, because with the Jessica Rabbit relationship, I did get a bit of a Pete Davidson Ariana Grande out of Roger and Jessica.
Well, there you go. Disney is making the live action versions of all their cartoons. We now know who should be doing it. But I do think the real sequel is what really came out of this, more than, yeah, the theme park ride and, yeah, the guy that wrote the novel wrote a couple more novels, all the stuff to try to cash in. The thing that truly got transformed here was Zemeckis himself. Yes, he did go on and make those Back to the Future sequels, but I think that working with animation and all of that technicality put him on the path to where he went, which is
ruin.
You know, perhaps you can, we've never reviewed them, but Uncanny Valley is, I think, how they're referred to. The Polar Express, the Beowulf, A Christmas Carol, and even this Marwyn. The attempt to bring always, Forrest Gump did it too, but the attempt to always bring in digitized characters to interact with live action characters was something that never left him after Roger Rabbit.
I mean, there were some weird ones in there, too. Like, I mean, it seemed like he was going more and more into this director type of way. I mean, Death Becomes Her was one after Back to the Future that really pushed CGI, that for some reason has been getting a lot of chatter on Twitter for Now Playing lately. But after Contact and Castaway, Polar Express, Beowulf, Christmas Carol, none of these movies do I want to see. Welcome to Marwyn. I haven't seen any of them because the trailers frighten me.
I like Beowulf. I'll go ahead and say it. I actually saw it in 3D, and I was not always convinced on the animation, but I actually thought they did a good job with the material.
Yeah, I mean, all those movies you mentioned all just feel like trying to push the envelope just for the sake of trying to push the envelope. And to my recollection, none of it worked. I haven't gone to see many of those movies, but what I have seen of them, you hit it on the nail on the head, Stuart. Uncanny Valley. It all just looks creepy and not quite there.
Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, we're done with Roger Rabbit. What are we doing next month? Another movie from 1988. One that I have been wanting to put on the calendar really as long as I've been on the show. Akira. Now, I've always said I'm not a comic book guy, but I collected this manga. I was a huge fan of the American printing of Akira, and it was the first time I ever went into an art movie. My brother took me to, drove all the way to Champaign, not 70 minutes away, to go see this in a theater. It is really the anime that kick off the trend in America. And we are covering it because thematically, it's so very similar to Dark Phoenix.
I'm the total newbie. I've heard of Akira.
Really? That's it?
That's it.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that'll be fun. I really look forward to your thoughts on the end.
Well, we will discuss that next month for you guys, our loyal patrons. In between, join us Tuesday as we find out, do I prefer Ryan Reynolds as an animated creature to Charles Fleischer?
Yeah, I think you already said. I think it's already, you didn't need to wait till Tuesday for that. But yes, is Ryan Reynolds enough to save it for you? Or will he be good? I mean, I shouldn't rule that out as a possibility. Will he finally win me over? Will I finally like Ryan Reynolds now that he's Pikachu?
Yeah, my biggest fear is that Mr. Mime will ruin it for me.
You and Mr. Mime, what happened? Where did it go so wrong? Me. Yeah.
So thank you for supporting us. Thank you for listening. And until next time, that's all, folks.
Let's go shake the weasels.
Nothing with you, baby Herman. You were great. You were perfect. You were better than perfect. This Roger, he keeps blowing his line.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
A laugh can be a very powerful thing. Why, sometimes in life, it's the only weapon we have.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
How much do you know about show business, Mr. Baggett?
Only there's no business like it. No business I know.
Yeah, and there's no business more expensive.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Please, oh, I can give you stars. Just drop the refrigerator in my head one more time.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
Is that a rabbit in your pocket? Are you just happy to see me?
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
You're magnificent.
Was I really?
Better than Goofy.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
Better lover than a driver, huh?
You'd better believe it, Buster.
Now Playing is edited by Arnie.
What timing! What finesse! What a genius!
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
This is the last time I work with someone with a speech impediment.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Me. What's up, Doc? Jumping without a parachute? Kinda dangerous, ain't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could get killed, huh?
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Here's to the pencil pushes. Maybe I'll get lead poisoning, huh?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2019. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Come on, Roger, let's go home. I'll bake you a carrot cake.
Boop, boop, be-doo.
Dip. No, not that nasty tobacco you put in your lip, but a mixture of chemicals that actually melt animated beings. And I'm sorry to anyone who, like, chews and listens to this show, but there's nothing nastier than a dip cup full of fucking spit.
It's gross. And unhealthy. That's my PSA.
I remember in college, one of my roommates poured a dip cup on another roommate's bed. Oh, God, gross, the smell. Ugh. Animated nipples always creep me out.
Always?
Always. You will notice no nipple.
You have duck tits. You have duck tits somewhere in a box.
Yeah, but that's latex.
Okay. These distinctions are very subtle. Shave.